This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote by Elaine Weiss. Read for you by Tavia Gilbert, with an introduction by the author.
In memory of my parents, who took their little girl into the voting booth, let her pull the magic curtain, and taught me to treasure my right to vote. And my dear friend, Natalie Moore Babbitt, who taught me how to be a writer. The time has come to shout aloud in every city, village, and hamlet, and in tones so clear and jubilant that they will reverberate from every mountain peak and echo from shore to shore, the woman's hour has struck. Carrie Chapman Catt, The Crisis, Presidential Address to the National American Woman Suffrage Association, September 1916. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. 19th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Introduction. On a Saturday evening in mid-July 1920, three women raced toward Nashville's Union Station on steam-powered trains. They each traveled alone, carrying a small suitcase, a handbag, a folder stuffed with documents. They were unremarkable in appearance, dressed in demure cotton dresses and summer hats. Their fellow passengers could hardly imagine the dramatic purpose they shared. They had all been summoned to command forces in what would prove to be one of the pivotal political battles in American history. This is the story of that battle, the furious campaign to secure the final state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, giving women the most fundamental right of democracy, the vote. Carrie Catt, the president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, the preeminent suffrage organization in the nation, was on a southbound train from New York City. Josephine Pearson, president of the Tennessee State Association opposed to women's suffrage, traveled north from her family home in the Cumberland Mountains of Tennessee. Sue White, a young activist for the National Woman's Party, the militant wing of the suffrage movement, came fresh from a protest in the Midwest. They converged on Nashville for the explosive climax of American women's seven-decade struggle for equal citizenship, and there was much at stake. 36 state approvals were required for ratification, and 35 were in hand. If the Tennessee legislature ratified the 19th Amendment, woman suffrage would become the law of the land, and 27 million women would be able to vote just in time for the fall presidential elections. If the legislature rejected it, the amendment might never be enacted. It all came down to Tennessee. There were powerful forces opposing federal woman suffrage as it approached the legal finish line. Political, corporate, and ideological adversaries intent upon stopping the 19th Amendment. Some of the most vociferous foes of enfranchisement were the anti-suffragists, the antis, such as Josephine Pearson, who feared that women's entrance into the polling booth would hasten the nation's moral collapse. The suffragists, the suffs, had reason to worry, as the amendment had already been rejected by nearly all the southern states, for the same blatantly racist reasons as put forth by Tennessee. If women got the vote, black women would also be entitled to the ballot. The presidential candidates were playing their own games, using women's suffrage as a pawn. This was the moment of reckoning, and both sides were willing to use every possible weapon to prevail. Over the course of the next 6 weeks, the three campaign commanders were joined by more than 1,000 women and men from around the state and across the country. Suffs, antis, governors and senators, political operatives, corporate lobbyists, and beleaguered legislators, all pouring into Nashville to enter the fray. The conflict quickly devolved into a vicious face-off, brimming with dirty tricks and cutting betrayals, sexist rancor, racial bigotry, booze, and the Bible, with the ghosts of the Civil War hovering over the proceedings and jitters lingering from the Great War amplifying the tension. The outcome remained in doubt until the very last moment. The intensity of this battle in Nashville, the strength and nature of the suffrage opposition, led by women, the racial dimensions of the conflict, and the uncertainty of the outcome may seem surprising to us now, even shocking. It's too easy to imagine that the enfranchisement of American women simply arrived, like some evolutionary imperative, a natural step in the gradual march of progress, or as a gift eventually bestowed by wise men on their grateful wives, daughters, and sisters. The women asked politely, staged a few picturesque marches, hoisted a few picket signs, and without much drama, votes for women was achieved. That's not how it happened. The very idea that women should have the right to participate in a government by and for the people was long considered radical, even dangerous in the United States. Despite Abigail Adams' exhortation in 1776 to her husband John to remember the ladies when forming the new American democracy, our esteemed founding fathers had absolutely no intention of giving women a voice in public affairs. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, women were condemned from the pulpit and in the press for thinking about suffrage. They were spit upon and pelted with rotten eggs for speaking out about it, and they were jailed for demanding it. The struggle for women's suffrage was a long, bitter fight. It was waged on street corners and atop soapboxes, in city halls, Grange halls, and the halls of Congress. It was fought in parlors and kitchens and bedrooms, under statehouse domes, at the bench of the U.S. Supreme Court, and finally in the Capitol building in Nashville and the elegant lobby of the nearby Hotel Hermitage. Winning the vote required 72 years of ceaseless agitation by three generations of dedicated, fearless suffragists who sought to overturn centuries of law and millennia of tradition concerning gender roles. The women who launched the movement were dead by the time it was completed. The women who secured its final success weren't born when it began. It took more than 900 local, state, and national campaigns involving tens of thousands of grassroots volunteers, financed by millions of dollars of mostly small and a few large donations by women across the country. The movement developed great women orators, talented executives, and tenacious lobbyists. It nurtured feminist philosophers and astute politicians who, though they had no legal standing or governmental representation, learned to manipulate the levers of political power and pull the strings of public opinion. Women who had never had public lives were emboldened to speak out, to march in the streets, even to raise picket signs in public protest for the first time. Some were more strongly radicalized in their quest for civic equality and became willing to commit acts of civil disobedience and go to jail in pursuit of the franchise. Through the decades, the cause changed the way women saw themselves and transformed society's view of women. The controversy over ratification of the 19th Amendment and, more broadly, the long battle over women's suffrage wasn't simply a political argument. It was also a social, cultural, and moral debate, a precursor to what we now call culture wars, raising issues that were complex and divisive. Allowing women to vote had the potential to not only upend the electoral process and the political status quo, but also alter societal and personal relations, and, according to suffrage's opponents, disturb the home and endanger the family. the political became the personal. And for many men, as well as some women, it was frightening. That women might oppose enfranchising and empowering their own sex seems counterintuitive, even preposterous. But the stance of the females against suffrage, the antis, opens a fascinating window on the role of social and religious conservatives in our public policy decisions. Like the key socio-political issues of today, from reproductive rights to same-sex marriage, attitudes towards women's suffrage divided communities, families, and friends, thrusting women into opposing camps. While this book chronicles a great triumph, women mobilizing for their own political freedom, it also poses some uncomfortable questions about the sincerity of American democracy, questions as urgent today as they were in 1920. Our cherished national self-image is of a proud democratic people, one where the citizens' right to vote is both a sacred trust and the cornerstone of our government by the people. But that image is only a partial reflection of reality. From the nation's founding, Americans have had, and continue to have, a deeply ambivalent attitude toward full participatory democracy and a conflicted stance towards universal suffrage. Voting rights have been a contested issue from the very beginning of the American experiment. When the founders wrote, "We the people," they really meant, "We the white wealthy men." Despite much lofty rhetoric, all men were not created equal, and women didn't count at all. The rest of our national history can be seen as a continuing push toward and reaction against expanding the franchise to include those groups of citizens purposely left outside. Fear of the mob, fear of the other, and fear for the erosion of white political hegemony made for slow and hesitant progress, punctuated by contractions and reversals. Access to or denial of the ballot became an instrument for gaining political party advantage, a dynamic put to use in Nashville and one that remains prevalent today, as voting rights for minority groups continue to be jeopardized by intimidation and violated by suppression, all for partisan ends. The cry of states' rights and antipathy toward federal oversight of voting rights were voiced loudly in Nashville in the summer of 1920 and still echo in newspaper headlines today. Holding the franchise, exercising the vote, is a form of power. So this book is, as suffrage leader Alice Paul once described her primary goal, about women claiming their rightful power of citizenship. And it is also about the forces that strenuously resisted that claim. "Power concedes nothing without a demand," insisted the great universal suffragist Frederick Douglass, and he taught this essential lesson to the early advocates of votes for women. But this sort of power cannot be wrested simply through demand. It requires a huge societal shift, a slow change of public attitudes eventually translated into public policy. Such change can be brought about only by decades of patient persuasion and persistent pressure, transforming an idea once considered unthinkable into something inevitable. Winning the franchise was a crucial milestone in American women's struggle to secure their legal, economic, and societal rights, claiming their place in the modern world. But that struggle continues. As this is an American story, it is inevitably about race. The cause of women's suffrage was, from the very beginning, entwined with contemporary efforts to emancipate and enfranchise the nation's black citizens. But the relationship between the movements was often tense. When the 19th Amendment reached its decisive hour in a southern city, the legacy of that historic alliance was tested, and prevailing racial bigotry played a dominant role. The long shadow of the Civil War and its violent aftermath also affect these events, the threat to Southern traditions and institutions, the power of states' rights, and the emotional scars of the Confederacy's defeat all come into play in Nashville, 55 years after the war's last battle. There is a heartening, even thrilling lesson to be found here too. Ordinary women banding together to become activists, keeping faith through decades of humiliation and discouragement to challenge an oppressive system and force change. There is also a chastening lesson to be learned from the moral compromises these mostly white, middle-class suffragists make in pursuit of their own freedom, leaving their black sisters and some of their own ideals behind. And in the actions of the forces aligned against suffrage, there is an instructive example of just how far some Americans were willing to go to protect their own careers, business interests, and entitlement by preventing others from obtaining their rights. The crusade for woman suffrage stands as one of the defining civil rights movements in the history of our country, and its organizing strategies, lobbying techniques, and nonviolent protest actions became the model for the civil rights campaigns to follow in the 20th and 21st centuries. Although these events took place almost a century ago, the story's compelling themes, power and political will, race and gender equality, states' rights and voting rights, and corporate influence in politics, remain urgent present-day concerns. It all begins with three women on their way to Nashville.
Chapter 1. To Nashville. Carrie Chapman Catt had spent a long night, day, and early evening on trains, clattering over 1,000 miles of track from New York City to Nashville. In the hours she wasn't reading field reports and legal documents, rimless eyeglasses perched on her nose, she read the newspapers and indulged in the guilty pleasure of a detective novel. By the time the train pulled into Nashville in the dusky twilight, it was hard to make out the copper and bronze statue of the messenger god Mercury perched atop the Union Station Tower, greeting travelers to the bustling capital city. Minerva, the warrior goddess, might have been a more fitting figure for the president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, Susan B. Anthony's anointed heir, the supreme commander of its great suffrage army, the woman they called the chief. Carrie Catt had been summoned to lead her troops into the fray one last time. At least she dearly hoped this might be the last time. She'd already devoted half of her life to the cause, 3 decades of constant work and travel. Her hair was silver and wavy, and she wore it short and brushed close, parted in the center, easy to groom on the run. Her face, once angular and strikingly handsome, was fleshier now. Her heavy eyelids drooped a bit, and the line of her jaw had softened, but she retained the same sly, thin-lipped smile, piercing blue eyes and arched eyebrows that made her look either surprised, amused, or annoyed, depending upon how she deployed them. She was definitely not amused this evening. She was worried, and she wasn't sure she could take the strain much longer. It was Kat's job, more precisely her life's mission, to guide American women to the promised land of political freedom, securing for them the most basic right of democracy, the vote. For more than 70 years, since that first audacious meeting in Seneca Falls in 1848, generations of her suffrage sisters had faced public disdain, humiliation, rotten eggs, violent opposition, and prison as they petitioned, campaigned, lobbied, marched, and pleaded for their simple rights as citizens. Now the promise of the franchise, so long delayed, was within sight. The political emancipation of half of the United States citizens was at stake. And here, of all places, where she'd never imagined it possible, in the South, in Nashville. Tennessee could become the elusive 36th state to ratify the federal woman suffrage amendment. Or it could end the quest in failure. The Tennessee legislature would soon be called into special session to vote on ratifying the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, popularly called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, one simple sentence stating that a citizen's right to vote could not be denied on account of sex. Nothing revolutionary, to Carrie Catt's mind. It was really just a clarification, an essential correction of the Founding Fathers' damned short-sightedness. Just over a year earlier, in June 1919, the amendment had finally been pushed through both houses of the U.S. Congress after 40 years of willful delay. Catt had kicked up her heels and broken into a wild dance when that news arrived. The amendment then moved to the states for ratification. She knew it would be a tough slog. Suffragists had to convince at least 36 state legislatures, three-quarters of the 48 states in the Union, to accept the amendment, while those opposed needed just 13 states to vote it down and kill it. The ratification campaign proved even slower and uglier than Catt expected. She had been sure it would be over by now, but it wasn't. By midsummer 1920, 35 states had ratified the amendment, 8 had rejected, 3 were refusing to consider. North Carolina and Tennessee were still up in the air, but North Carolina was a sure bet to reject. That left only Tennessee as a possible 36th state. If the Tennessee legislature could be persuaded, pressured, cajoled, and coerced, all these techniques would be needed, Catt was certain, to ratify the amendment, suffrage would become federal law, allowing every woman in every state to vote in all elections. Victory at last! Hallelujah! And just in time for the upcoming presidential election. But if Tennessee did not ratify, derailing the full enfranchisement of 27 million women before the fall elections, all might be lost. The momentum was stalling after several state legislatures had voted down ratification this past spring and summer. Although the no votes in Georgia and Louisiana had surprised no one, nearly every southern state of the old Confederacy had rejected the amendment. The loss in more moderate mid-Atlantic Delaware was a shock. A defeat in Tennessee, which enjoyed stronger suffrage sympathies and deeper organization than the other southern states, would allow the forces against suffrage to gain strength, new legal obstacles to be thrown into the path, men to forget what women had contributed to the Great War effort, women to lose heart. That crucial sense of inevitability, the public assumption that to support woman suffrage was simply to keep in step with the march of progress, was faltering. And that infuriating question, is America really ready for women to vote, to be equal citizens, was bubbling up again. Adding to her agitation, the newspapers were filled with the sorts of stories that gave Americans good reason to be in a sour mood. Even after 17 million people had been killed in the so-called Great War, the world was still aflame. The Russian Bolsheviks were invading Poland and vowing to advance into Romania and Bulgaria, Latvia and Lithuania. The Ottoman Turks were fighting the Greeks while continuing to massacre and deport Armenians. The Irish nationalist Sinn Féin was skirmishing with British troops. Mexico was spiraling into civil war again. Factions were battling in China. The premise, trumpeted by so many posters and in so many parades, that American men had fought and died in the war to end all wars, looked to be a fake. Even the peace seemed chimerical. The negotiations in Paris had dragged on for months, and the U.S. Senate had recently refused to accept the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, objecting to President Wilson's plan for a League of Nations to settle international disputes. Americans wanted nothing more to do with foreign entanglements. Catt thought the League was the only good thing to come out of the horrible war. She'd written and spoken in its favor, and was disgusted by the backlash against it. The war had brought neither the peace nor the prosperity the nation had been promised. As Catt's train sped toward Nashville, streetcar workers were striking in Chicago. Coal miners were stuck in long, bloody lockouts in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Illinois. Garment workers were threatening in New Jersey. There'd been nationwide steel mill, coal, railroad, and shipbuilding strikes in 1919, more than 2,000 strikes around the country, while race riots had erupted in many cities. The post-war economic recession had now deepened into a full-blown depression. National prohibition, which Kat had supported as a way to protect women and children from alcohol-fueled abuse, was only adding to the climate of violence. As federal agents pulled their enforcement shotguns on backwoods moonshiners and city bootleggers, while mobsters jockeyed for turf with machine guns. Anarchists were taking advantage of the turmoil, and accounts of exploding bombs in mail packages, in cars and in offices and homes were a staple news item. The government was responding with raids, mass arrests, and deportations of suspected radicals. A pair of Italian anarchists, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, had recently been arrested in Massachusetts, authorized by Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, whose own home had been bombed the year before. The Palmer raids were executed by his ambitious young assistant, J. Edgar Hoover, who began keeping secret files on those who questioned or criticized the government, anyone who wasn't a good American. Carrie Catt was also being watched. And every day this summer, there was another article about a cheeky fellow in Boston named Charles Ponzi, who had convinced thousands of people to give him their money with promises of too-good-to-be-true investment returns. Double your money in 90 days. Ponzi's clever pyramid scheme was definitely too good to be true, and he would soon be under arrest. Even the national pastime, baseball, was under a cloud of suspicion. Rumors were circulating that several Chicago White Sox players had deliberately made bad plays to throw the 1919 World Series in exchange for cash from gamblers. All this only added to the national dyspepsia. Americans felt as if they'd been fed too many lies, taken for chumps one too many times. The newly minted presidential candidates had quickly picked up on the zeitgeist. Republican nominee Warren Harding was already talking about a return to normalcy and America First, which Kat understood meant a retreat from progressive ideas and a slide back to comfortable conservative policies. Democrat James Cox was carefully hedging his bets on everything. If the amendment didn't pass now, before the election, before the nation swung into an isolationist, reactionary frame of mind, it might never pass at all. Miss Josephine Pearson was dusty from the soot flying into her train's open windows and a bit stiff from the hard wooden slat seat, but she didn't mind the discomfort. Pearson had received a telegram earlier that Saturday at her home in Monteagle, a hamlet perched high on Tennessee's Cumberland Plateau. It warned that Carrie Catt was coming. "Our forces are being notified to rally at once. Send orders. And come immediately." She was to take command in Nashville. The summons thrilled her. As president of the Tennessee State Association opposed to women's suffrage, and also head of the state division of the Southern Women's League for the rejection of the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, Josephine was the proud leader of the Tennessee Antis. Now the fight had come to her volunteer state. This would be Tennessee's time of trial, and, she prayed, triumph. With God's help, it would meet the challenge of beating back the scourge of women's suffrage, holding fast against the feminist epidemic sweeping the nation and now threatening her home. This was her crusade, and this was her moment. She was 52 years old, and all of her training, college, graduate degrees, and her years as an educator, had prepared her for this mission. She knew she was doing God's will, fulfilling a sacred vow to her beloved mother, who had understood the dangers of female suffrage, how it mocked the plan of the Creator, undermined women's purity and the noble chivalry of men, and threatened the home and the family. The Bible said a woman's place was in the home, as loving wife and mother, not in the dirty realm of politics, not in the polling booth or in the jury box, where her delicate sensibilities could be assaulted, her morals sullied and even corrupted. Her men knew what was best for her, would protect and cherish her, make laws and decisions for her benefit. Pearson felt there was no need to question the wisdom of Tennessee men or Tennessee laws. But the threat went beyond this. Woman suffrage could upend the supremacy of the white race and the Southern way of life. After the brutal disruptions of the Civil War and the upheavals of Reconstruction, when black men were allowed to vote, and some were even elected to the legislature, but former Confederate soldiers were considered traitors and stripped of their voting rights, the Southern states had finally achieved a degree of equilibrium in terms of restoring racial and political relations, the Pearson family believed. Jim Crow laws kept blacks in their place. But if a federal amendment mandated suffrage for all women, that would mean black women, too. Then Washington could demand that black men be allowed to vote, and that was totally unacceptable. Barely a week before Mother had died in the summer of 1915, in the library of their house on the Methodist Assembly grounds in Monteagle, Father was a retired Methodist minister, Amanda Pearson had grasped Josephine's hand and implored, "Daughter, when I'm gone, if the Susan B. Anthony Amendment issue reaches Tennessee, promise me you will take up the opposition in my memory." Josephine bent to kiss her mother's brow, to impress the vow upon her forehead, and answered, "Yes, God helping, I'll keep the faith, Mother." So when the telegram arrived late Saturday afternoon, it was with a sense of holy purpose that Josephine Pearson quickly packed her travel case, walked from her house to the Monteagle Depot, and bought a one-way ticket for the late train to Nashville. Even before Josephine made the vow to her mother, she had come to the conclusion that suffrage was a dangerous idea. She arrived at this judgment by what she considered empirical and scholarly investigation, as befitted a woman with higher education and intellectual accomplishments. Early in her career, she served as a high school principal and went on to teach English and history at Nashville College for Young Ladies and Winthrop State Normal College for Women in South Carolina. In 1909, she assumed the position of dean and chair of philosophy at Christian College in Columbia, Missouri, at a time when Missourians were debating a woman's suffrage measure. She found she often fell into argument with her colleagues and students about women's suffrage, and was frequently the sole naysayer at the faculty table. She began to feel isolated, shunned for her resistance against the popular political tide. She came to resent her faculty colleagues who snubbed her and used their positions to coerce their impressionable students with their terrible suffrage ideas. During semester breaks, Josephine undertook her own version of field research to determine whether women in those few western states where females already had the right to vote, such as Wyoming, were really better off for having the franchise. She collected her own data and conducted interviews, and came to the conclusion that suffrage had exposed women to the filth of politics without improving their lives at all. She began to give lectures to anti-suffrage audiences and found herself hailed as an anti-leader in the state. Her academic career in Missouri was cut short in the spring of 1914 by the call to come home to care for her ailing mother, and she returned to Monteagle to nurse her mother and aged father. From her sickbed, Mother continued to write her diatribes against the evils of whiskey and suffrage, and after her death, honoring the vow, Josephine continued the work. She sat at her desk, writing deep into the night, sending her missives to the newspapers in Nashville and Memphis and Chattanooga. The publisher of the Chattanooga Times, Adolf Ox, was especially welcoming to her anti-suffrage proclamations. Ox's editorial pages, in both his Chattanooga paper and its sister publication, the New York Times, were firmly in her anti-camp. Pearson's dedication was recognized, and she was eventually tapped to become president of the Tennessee Anti-Suffragists. And now, like the Confederate generals whose brave exploits had been extolled in her family's parlor, whose names and deeds she knew by heart, she would stand in defense of the South. Sue Shelton White departed Columbus, Ohio for Nashville on July 17th, just as 500 purple, white, and gold suffrage banners and two trunks of picket signs were being readied for action. Sue White and Alice Paul and a dozen other National Woman's Party leaders had gone to Ohio to confront the two men who wanted to be the next president of the United States. Both were from Ohio, which made logistics easier. Governor James Cox was the surprise compromise choice of the fractious Democrats. Warren G. Harding, senator from Ohio, emerged as the Republican candidate. Both seemed like spineless men, eager to please, but probably unwilling to put any muscle behind completing the ratification of the 19th Amendment. They'd need to be convinced. Alice Paul had already announced to the newspapers that her National Woman's Party shock troops were ready to descend, wave their banners, break out their picket signs, and spend the rest of the summer and fall camped outside Cox's office in Columbus and Harding's home in Marion. She had her eye on the vice presidential candidates, too, Franklin Roosevelt in New York and Calvin Coolidge in Massachusetts. Whichever party did not come through for the nation's women at this crucial juncture would be punished, she promised. Sue White was by now, at age 33, a veteran picketer. 2 years before, she'd left Mrs. Catt's mainstream suffrage organization to join the more aggressive National Woman's Party, hereafter referred to as the Woman's Party, which had itself splintered from Catt's NAWSA, also known as NAWSA, and hereafter referred to as the National, in a dispute over both strategy and tactics. And now, White was one of Miss Paul's trusted deputies at headquarters in Washington, the party's research director, and chairwoman of the Woman's Party in her native Tennessee. A few weeks before, she was hoisting a picket sign in front of the Chicago Coliseum, where the Republican Party was in convention. A year earlier, she had been arrested and imprisoned for burning President Wilson in effigy at the gates of the White House. After serving her 5 days of incarceration, she signed up for the Prison Special Railroad Tour, joining 25 of her jailbird Woman's Party comrades, dressed in well-tailored facsimile prison outfits, on a nationwide lecture tour. Pleading and quiet protestation no longer suited Sue White. She was no longer a genteel Tennessee suffrage lady, like those in Mrs. Catt's camp who abided by the motto, "Graciousness is our watchword," while waiting for men to do them the honor of giving them the vote. She was now one of those suffragists called a militant, a radical, a fanatic, a zealot, and she was proud of it. White had once been a loyal and active member of Mrs. Catt's National Association, a follower of the moderate, plodding, polite approach to gaining suffrage. Being polite was an important social virtue in Tennessee. Even if you were advocating for something as socially unacceptable as women entering the voting booth or taking a seat in a jury box. Sue White had an unfailingly sunny disposition and a quick, warm smile, but she had no patience for the empty niceties of the society set of Nashville or Memphis or Knoxville. She was not part of that world. She grew up poor, was orphaned while still a girl, had to support herself. She became a first-rate court reporter, and she built her own thriving stenography agency. She made her own way. She wanted to study law. It bothered her that she could not serve on the juries whose decisions she dutifully transcribed, but the lawyers at the courthouse laughed at the idea, told her she was being impractical. Nevertheless, she still hoped to become a lawyer someday. Slim and lithe, her brunette hair cut in a fashionable bob, her dresses simple but stylish, her hat set at a jaunty angle, Sue looked the part of a modern career woman. Sweet but sassy, with a steely resolve behind soft brown eyes, she called herself a practical idealist. Those who saw her in action called her Lady Warrior. Everyone liked working with Miss Sue, as she was affectionately called, men as well as women. They respected her intelligence, appreciated her sense of fairness, marveled at her energy, enjoyed her sense of humor. She had actually admired the national suffrage women she had worked with in Tennessee, finding them sincere and brave enough to confront the ridicule they faced in their churches, their clubs, and even their homes for their suffrage stance. But these women inhabited a different social world from the one in which Sue lived. They came from old southern families and old money, lived in fine houses, had husbands and servants, did not need to work to pay the rent for a flat. Though she'd spent more than a decade working with these women within Mrs. Katz's National Association, White now felt more comfortable in Alice Paul's Woman's Party. Paul had rejected the national state-by-state approach to gaining suffrage. She insisted that all efforts be put toward a federal amendment and demanded that Congress and President Wilson put it through, or else. Paul vowed to make them the target of public spectacles and protests, the kind the nation had never before seen, and she followed through on the threat. Kat and the National wouldn't tolerate this risky, militant strategy. Whether Paul and her rebellious cohort were expelled or voluntarily broke away from the mother organization in late 1913 makes little difference. The American movement split into two rival camps. The Woman's Party staff was filled with ambitious, impatient, and mostly single young women who could no longer tolerate their second-class citizenship, refused to wait, and were willing to make a fuss. Sue White felt at home among them. The telegrams and letters urging Carrie Catt to hurry to Tennessee had begun arriving while she was tending her summer flower garden at Juniper Ledge, her house in the town of Briarcliff Manor, about 30 miles north of New York City. It had been such a welcome, if brief, time at home, after more than a year of crisscrossing the country, overseeing the state ratification drives. She had just returned from a trip to Geneva, Switzerland, where she presided over the conference of the International Woman Suffrage Alliance, of which she was also president, in its first meeting since the end of the war. It had been a humiliation. More than 20 nations had already granted the vote to women, including Germany. It was a national disgrace to have just fought a war to make the world safe for democracy and yet not allow half the citizens of America to participate in that democracy. As much as she disagreed, vehemently disagreed with Alice Paul and the flamboyant tactics her Woman's Party had employed during the war, Kat had to admit some of the slogans on their picket signs rang true. Democracy begins at home. Indeed. Kat sailed home from Europe in the last days of June and was met at the dock with the news that Tennessee might come into play. She dispatched her young aide-de-camp, Marjorie Schuller, to Nashville to survey the situation. Marjorie helped with publicity efforts in the ratification states, was a quick study, and had learned to spot trouble. She'd been in Delaware in May, when the ratification fight took an unexpected bad turn after the Anti's corporate friends swooped into Wilmington with money and gifts and threats. What had seemed like a sure thing had turned into a disastrous disappointment, not only a victory for the Anti's, but a dangerous shift in the ratification momentum. The suffragists couldn't allow that to happen again. Scouting in Nashville, Marjorie met with the Tennessee suffrage leaders, talked to the politicians, read the newspapers, and listened to talk in the hotel lobbies. It was a hornet's nest. The Tennessee suffragists were fractious. The legislature had a well-deserved reputation for susceptibility to bribery. Governor Albert Roberts was embroiled in a nasty primary fight to hold on to his job, and getting tangled in the politics of the amendment's ratification was the last thing he wanted to do. He was being pressured by the White House and the National Democratic Party to call the legislature back into special session to deal with ratification, but he was holding up the amendment for political ransom. He would convene the legislature only after his primary, and, presumably, only if he won. All this dissension made organizing difficult and gave the Antis a ripe opportunity. Marjorie feared the same forces that had sunk the amendment in Delaware were poised to converge and torpedo ratification in Tennessee. "Advise Chief," Schuller wired to the national headquarters in New York. "Political situation exactly like Delaware, only worse. Regard outlook hopeless under present conditions." Kat had wanted nothing more than to stay at home at Juniper Ledge. She was tired. Her deep-set blue eyes circled in dark, puffy rings. She was tormented by migraine headaches. She was 61 years old and had been fighting this battle for so long. She could still feel the sting of the very first time she had confronted the idea of woman suffrage. She hadn't yet known it was a cause, many years ago, sitting at her family's kitchen table. Carrie Lane was a pigtailed Iowa farm girl then, bookish and inquisitive, with the earnest self-confidence of a child who knows she is clever. She devoured historical tomes while perched high in a swaying tree bough, taught herself anatomy by pickling rodents' brains in her mother's canning jars, and loved riding her horse to the one-room schoolhouse down the road. Carrie was hungry to learn how the world worked, and to be part of it. Lively political discussions were a dinner table staple in the Lane family. Carrie read the newspapers. She liked to chime in. But on Election Day 1872, with incumbent Ulysses Grant facing off against crusading newspaper publisher Horace Greeley, 13-year-old Carrie watched as her father and the farm's hired men prepared to ride into town to vote, dressed in their Sunday best, while her smart, politically-minded mother, an ardent Greeley supporter, remained in her house frock. "Shouldn't she be getting ready to go with the other grown-ups?" Carrie asked her mother. "Wasn't she going to vote for Greeley?" Carrie's father, her older brother, and the hired hands erupted in peals of laughter. Worst of all, even her mother laughed. She still remembered the bewilderment and embarrassment, the hot tears welling up. "Women couldn't vote. Only men," her father explained. "Didn't she realize that?" It was too important a civic duty to be left to women. Carrie grew angry. Her mother knew as much about the candidates and the issues as her father, maybe even more. Her smirking brother Charles was no smarter than she was. The guffawing farmhands couldn't even read. Carrie could hear the men still laughing in the wagon as they drove off toward town. She felt as if she'd been slapped. She dedicated her life to changing the laws that barred women from voting. Now, here she was, a twice-widowed woman, twice elected to the presidency of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. Her name was familiar in every American home and foreign capital. Her comments appeared on the front pages of all the newspapers, and her notes to the White House were given prompt reply. She could demand audiences with kings, presidents and senators, prime ministers, maharajas, and cigar-chomping mayors. She was the leader of a giant army. Nearly 2 million women and men were members of the National Association's local affiliates. Millions more were supporters and sympathizers. And in the International Woman Suffrage Alliance, the women of dozens of nations were organizing and agitating under her guidance. She led them with soaring oratory and nuts-and-bolts directives, with emotional exhortation and legalistic logic, always leavened with a sprinkle of dry humor. During her years in the movement, she'd seen slow, agonizingly slow progress. On the wall of her office at the national headquarters, as well as on the wall of Alice Paul's Woman's Party offices in Washington, hung a large suffrage map of the United States, with different colors and patterns marking the types of suffrage available to women in each state. States hold the power to make their own election laws, unless superseded by federal law. The map looked like a crazy quilt of dots, stripes, and crosshatches, designating the states where women enjoyed full suffrage, able to vote in all elections and primaries, and where they could vote only in certain types of elections, such as school board or municipal or presidential. State politicians seemed more amenable to granting this kind of limited suffrage, as they could be confident that women would have no say in state policy decisions or patronage. Colored in black on the map were the states where there was still no franchise for women at all, and little chance there ever would be. The federal amendment was the only way to equalize the map, painted all in a radiant, full suffrage design. She was a firm believer in evolution, in both biological and social realms. Her faith in it kept her optimistic, confident of progress. Now it was her job to carry its glorious prospect to Tennessee. For Carrie Catt, Woman suffrage was not simply a political goal. It was nothing less than the next logical step in the moral evolution of humankind. Union Station was the pride of Nashville, a flying buttressed Castle Grand monument to the capital city's energy and commerce, a gray limestone temple dedicated to the power of the railroad industry in Tennessee. But for Josephine Pearson, pulling into Union Station was like entering the large, very large house of family friends. Indeed, the man who envisioned and built the station, Major Eugene Kastner Lewis, was something of a godfather to Josephine. The likeness of Louise Lewis, one of the major's four daughters, all of whom were Josephine's good friends, loomed above the whole station, emerging from the south wall in the form of a classically berobed bas-relief figure of Miss Nashville. Pearson was born just 3 years after the Confederacy's fall, in the fraught time of Reconstruction, when Tennesseans felt punished and humiliated. She was spoon-fed horror tales of the Civil War, laced with nostalgia for the lost cause, a potent combination that made a deep impression. This federal amendment, with its demand that Tennessee sacrifice its honor and traditions, submit once again to Washington's yoke, harkened back to those times, stirring bitter memories. It must be repulsed. Tennesseans must not allow Nashville to be besieged by Yankees once again. It must not allow carpetbaggers from the North to further rend the South's social fabric. Mrs. Catt might come to Tennessee with her Northern lady troops and her regalia and fancy weapons, but the feminist peril would be halted here. As Josephine Pearson saw it, this was a fight for the soul of Tennessee. It was a holy war. Pearson was a patriot and a civic-minded woman, active in the Monegal Ladies' Club, her local Methodist church, and her chapter of the Woman's Christian Temperance Union. She did her bit for the Red Cross during the war, and advocated for economic development through better roads as chairwoman of the Cumberland Division of the Dixie Highway Association Ladies' Auxiliary. She believed in duty, and so Josephine Pearson suspended her teaching career to give all her time to anti-suffrage work, mortgaging her property and taking boarders into the old house in Monegal to make ends meet. While her train approached the Nashville station, Sue White had time to reflect upon the meeting a day earlier in Columbus with the Democratic presidential candidate, Governor Cox. It had gone rather well, she thought. With the threat of Woman's Party picketers outside his door ready to pounce, he was most conciliatory, issuing a strong pro-suffrage statement to the press and promising to do all he could to line up Governor Roberts and all the Tennessee Democrats behind the ratification drive. Satisfied for the moment with Cox's professed intentions, Alice Paul and her Ohio troops were now turning their fire toward the Republican candidate, Senator Harding, who expected to officially accept his party's nomination from the front porch of his home in Marion the following week. The Woman's Party would be there to greet him. Now, however, Sue White was needed in Nashville to launch the party's campaign in Tennessee. She had already scoped out the situation, and it did not present a pretty picture. She had given Miss Paul her candid assessment in a long letter. "The more I look into the Tennessee situation, the more I realize that we face a terrific fight," she told Paul. "The anti-suffragists have already begun work, appealing, as they always do in Southern campaigns, to deeply seated prejudices and pouring vitriol into old wounds. Unless suffragists committed themselves fully and fought relentlessly," she warned, "Tennessee was in danger of being lost. And perhaps, with it, the amendment." Now it was going to be Sue White's job to run that relentless campaign. She had never been fully in charge of a state campaign before, and it gave her a bit of a shiver to think of the challenges that lay ahead. She knew full well that the Woman's Party could not do it alone. In truth, there were not that many members of the Woman's Party in Tennessee. The state's mainstream suffrage leaders were appalled by the party's tactics, and the average Tennessean still considered the party's picketing and protest actions during the war unpatriotic. To accomplish the all-important goal of ratification, Sue White understood that she was going to have to forge some sort of working relationship with her erstwhile state suffrage colleagues. It might be awkward, but White was willing to swallow a slice of humble pie for the sake of the cause. The train arrived, and White mounted the steps from the platform into Union Station's glass-ceilinged main hall. On the far side of the hall was a bas-relief replica of the 1900 limited train, pulled by a bully 108 locomotive, the pride of the LNN line, seeming to burst through the wall. On another wall was the Grand Station clock, guarded by the figures of Time and Progress, with Mr. Progress gripping a railroad wheel to his chest. All around her, draped over each of the station's archways, were the angels of Tennessee commerce. 20 carved, winged maidens, each holding an important state resource or product in her outstretched hands. A sheaf of barley, bowl of cotton, lump of coal, ingot of ore, cornucopia of fruit, and flask of whiskey, good Tennessee bourbon, all the products the railroad carried to market to make the state great and prosperous. As she hurried through the station, Sue White must have realized she was surrounded by the symbolic renderings of the powerful interests, railroads, liquor, and manufacturing, that would soon be arrayed against her and her cause. Carrie Cat braced herself as her train pulled into the station at about 8:30 that Saturday evening. A comb would be a good idea. Her hair was probably a fright. Her careful center part off kilter. There would certainly be reporters at the station, and she had better prepare something clever to say. She noticed that reporters these days enjoyed getting quotes from Alice Paul. She provided them with florid, perfectly sensational material, a far cry from Carrie's own carefully modulated statements. It galled Cat no end. She had not modulated her own statements to her Tennessee suffrage leaders. During the past 2 weeks, she'd mailed them stern, pointed letters of instruction and admonition. They were very fine and capable women, but she warned them. They had to set aside their silly rivalries and pull together, presenting an absolute, united, optimistic front turned toward the enemy. And they had better get ready for an ugly fight. The anti-suffs will flood Tennessee with the most outrageous literature it has ever been your lot to read, she told them, drawing from her experience in the other southern states. It will contain outright lies, innuendos, and near-truths, which are more damaging than lies. It will be extremely harmful, and the nigger question will be put forth in the ways to arouse the greatest possible prejudice. The race issue always reared its ugly head in the South. Whatever you do, or whatever you think, allow me to urge you not to underestimate the power of the opposition, which will be applied to the 36th state. Cat shared her deep misgivings with Ann Dudley, the Nashville suffrage leader to whom she felt closest, in a chillingly candid evaluation of the situation, written just 4 days before she boarded the train for Nashville. At this time, I do not believe that there is a ghost of a chance of ratification in Tennessee. When Cat stepped off the train, Marjorie Schuller was there on the platform to greet her, along with Catherine Kenny, a seasoned Nashville suffrage veteran who was shepherding the ratification effort for Cat's new League of Women Voters. They had a red cap take Mrs. Cat's little travel bag up the long flight of stairs, from the platforms into the Union Station main hall. And as they made their way up the steps, they briefed Mrs. Cat on what awaited. The reporters were there, the press swarming Mrs. Cat as she entered the grand hall. "I've come to look over the situation," she pronounced rather breezily. She would be staying no longer than a few days. "All the states consider Tennessee the queen of the southern states and the leader in all progressive matters," Cat told the reporters. Suffrage supporters feel certain that Tennessee will rise to the occasion and use its decisive vote for the women. The eyes of the country and the world are centered here at Nashville. Carrie Catt was demonstrating that confident, optimistic attitude that she'd urged the suffrage women of Tennessee to adopt, whether she believed it or not. The Hotel Hermitage in Nashville was a much grander place than Josephine Pearson might normally have chosen. When she registered at the desk, she requested the cheapest room, and